So I remember when we were having this conversation last time, right? And you were talking about your discovery of kind of getting into healing and the practice you got into. And before you actually got into the concept of seven tools of healing, can you kind of remind me and also kind of let's go into your journey of how you actually got into this, you know, discovery of wisdom and understanding the inner truth and how healing could happen from there. So
yeah, I appreciate that. I think that I have a pretty strong background in science. I have an undergraduate degree in chemistry and then another undergraduate degree in material science and engineering. I worked a lot with polymers and surface chemistry and that sort of thing as an undergraduate. And so I also was fascinated by the process of science, not just the content of science, but how does science actually work? How do you know that what you know is really true? And so a very important part of science is the data, you know, the actual you know, numbers that you collect from your experiment. And in medicine, the data is all of human experience. Right? And the theories that we come up with are just our best attempts to try to explain the data. And so one of the most unscientific things a scientist can do is discard data just because it doesn't fit with the dominant theory at the time. And all the great discoveries happen because somebody didn't do that, right? They didn't throw away an unexplained observation. You got to figure out how to explain it.
Yeah.
So when I got into medicine, I thought I had really trained myself to think and problem solve. And I was really shocked when I got into medical school and all they really asked me to do is memorize things. Memorizing anatomy and memorizing all the drugs.
Yeah.
And I hated memorizing things. I never memorized formulas. I always wanted to understand how to derive the formula.
Yeah.
You know, what your formula was actually saying. And so that threw me for a bit of a loop, actually. And I had to actually take a year off of medical school after my first year to do some soul searching and figure out what I really wanted to do. And I did decide that medicine is what I wanted to do. So I came back to medical school and really jumped in. And I think I learned a lot. But what happened was, you know, so one of the things we learn in medical school is what we call the medical model, which is how we try to explain disease and health and that kind of thing. And one of the things I noticed almost right away was how many human experiences don't fit the medical model. Right? The most common example is the placebo effect. It doesn't fit the medical model. Because the medical model sees you as just a skin bag of biochemical reactions. And the idea is, well, if we can just understand those biochemical reactions enough, then we can pour in other chemicals and you can be the person you want to be in your life. So that's the assumption that's driving most of the pharmacological research and all that kind of thing. And the push for designer drugs is that phrase. All these psychoactive drugs. So just take a pill and be happy, be yourself. Well, I started collecting so many experiences from my patients that didn't fit that model. Like one woman cured her husband's Crohn's disease by putting him on an organic food diet. Well, when I studied Crohn's disease, they didn't even talk about diet as a treatment. They might now, but this was back in the 70s. And I thought, that's weird. They don't talk about diet, but there's somebody that's actually cured themselves from this horrible, incurable disease. So what do you do with that experience, right? That data. And so what a scientist would do is say, well, we've got to find a better model. And so I started searching a lot of other world healing traditions to see what they had to say. You know, so I looked into nutrition, I looked into what naturopaths offer. I looked into chiropractic and different kinds of body work. I looked into Ayurvedic medicine, into Chinese medicine, homeopathy. There's a lot of different ways of treating people.
Sure. Right? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And started to say, well, what can I take that they're doing and add to what I'm doing to expand it more?
Yeah.
And how do you get it all fit together? Mm-hmm. And that's when I came across Ken Wilber's work on the, it's called the Integral Worldview. And he asked the question, he says, you know, this is the first time in world history that we've had access to all of human knowing, mm-hmm. all at the same time and place. And he says, well, what do all the different traditions have to say about going from a newborn baby to a fully actualized human being?
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at what all the different traditions say, maybe we can, you know, again, pick and choose what works from all the different ones and let the dogma go and find a roadmap how to mm-hmm. do that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think I'm doing, what I'm trying to do anyway, is apply those ideas to medicine. Mm-hmm. And like, for example, try to think of one thing in your life that has no influence on your health whatsoever.
One thing in my life that has no influence on my health.
I think
everything does, yeah, no?
Yeah, right? Everything does. And so you really need a medicine that can take your whole life into account.
Yeah.
Well, your life is more than just about chemistry.
Yeah.
You have beliefs, you have desires, you have fears, you have the influence of your family and friends.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You have the influence from the environment
mm-hmm.
with, pollution or whatever. So the medical model needs to take all that into account. Mm-hmm. One of the best ways to do that is with Ken Wilber's four quadrant idea. And so that's why I call what I do integral medicine now at this point after mm-hmm. the integral worldview. There's a thing in medicine that you can't make a diagnosis if you don't think of it.
You can't make diagnosis if you can't think of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if it doesn't pop into your head, you're never going to make that diagnosis, right?
Right.
So,
okay.
So one of the ways we're trained is to listen to a person's story, examine them physically, do whatever labs we have to, and then, you know, so collect all this information and then try to come up with as many possible explanations for this set of symptoms and signs that we can. And that's called a differential diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the first things I did back while I was still a resident was starting adding new things to the differential diagnosis that conventional medicine didn't really take into account, like mm-hmm. food allergies and yeast infection in your colon or adrenal fatigue. Or,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I started adding those things and thinking, well, that's going to make a difference. But that didn't really help everybody. There's still all these, you know, people having problems that medicine couldn't help.
Mm.
But there's also people getting better and medicine couldn't explain how they got better.
Mm.
Like spontaneous remission from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Spontaneous remission. There's a woman who was an RN at Evie McDonald who healed her Lou Gehrig's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Her ALS, which is 100% fatal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you start looking, somebody's healed just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you explain that?
Yeah.
And if one person can do it, that means other people could potentially do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking at all this stuff. And my first practice out of residency, I went to a small town up in central Maine and became the only doctor in the small town up there. But while I was there, I went down to Boston and studied some clinical hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And by studying the clinical hypnosis, that really taught me how to think about the mind and how the mind works in a whole different way than what we learn about in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I started using it to get kids' warts to go away, started using it to treat their asthma to go away. You know, there's all kinds of things you could do with this hypnosis. And then I also started studying body work, and I came across a form of body work called craniofacial therapy, which is a subspecialty of osteopathy. And I started putting the cranial sacral therapy together with the hypnosis. So when you're doing body work, since your unconscious mind runs your body, right? While you're doing body work, it's really good. And hypnosis is a way of kind of raising the curtain between your conscious and your unconscious mind so that they can talk to each other a little more easily. It was, really made sense to put them together and go in and start exploring, well, what is the body trying to say by creating these symptoms? And so I had people starting to have conversations with their headache, or conversations with their tumors, or conversations with their back. And that's when I started noticing. It's like, hey, there's like this deep wisdom operating underneath all this stuff. And just about everybody I worked with had it. I don't think I've ever met a person that didn't have a deep wisdom inside of them. And it kind of makes sense, because if you think about all the things that are going on in your body, like, how many biochemical pathways are operating in your body? Like,
how would I know that? I wouldn't know the numbers, right?
Millions, right?
Right.
And they all have to stay in balance with each other.
Sure.
In order for your body to work, right? So how do you coordinate all that to keep it in balance? That's one of the jobs of the inner wisdom, is to run your body. And so by paying attention to your body, you can kind of get your foot in the door. And that was my foot in the door into this inner wisdom.
Into this inner wisdom journey.
Through the body, yeah.
Right.
And so then I started asking myself the question, well, what characteristics does this inner wisdom have? How would you describe it to people? And what I noticed is it had almost all the characteristics that, you know, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we ascribe to God. You know, it's very, always very kind, it's very wise, and knowing, you know, it just can be the answers. It's the source of people's intuition, you know. It knew what the imbalance was in their body. It knew how to correct the imbalance. So that's when I started looking more into the concept of consciousness. I call it with a capital C. And it turns out discipline from as different as quantum mechanics and the Vedic tradition and Native American shamanism. And, I mean, everywhere you look, there's this concept of this organizing consciousness that in physics they see it as outside of time and space, outside of physics. And the whole universe is just like solidified or precipitated aspect of that consciousness. And so then what I saw was that as humans, we can tap into that consciousness. We have access to it. And parts of that consciousness are coming through veil between the you know, beyond physics and inside the laws of physics, and becoming our life. And so I asked the question, what are the determinants of this conscious expression? And do we have any say over that? And some of the determinants, I think, are somewhat fixed, but at least harder to get to, like the genetics. I mean, you know, it might be theoretically possible to change your eye color or whatever, but most people don't do that, right?
Probably the skin, maybe.
But you know, I'm expressing different aspects of consciousness than this plant is, because they have different genetics.
Right.
About chemistry is actually not all that different. And so, but what aspects do we have any control over? And what I saw was that beliefs are a major determinant of our conscious expression. And that's behind the sayings like Goethe said, man is as he believes.
So the beliefs, sorry to cut you there. So the belief is the belief system, or belief in general?
Well, I think about a belief as sort of like a solidified thought form.
Okay.
So it's more persistent. And so, if your thoughts were the river, belief would be the frozen ice.
Right. Okay.
In the river, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have who knows how many thousands of beliefs. So that forms a belief system.
Right.
We have a whole bunch of beliefs. But the beliefs, that what I found is they have two jobs. Mm-hmm. So one job is they're literally the lenses that we peer through to see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so they determine how we interpret our experience.
Mm-hmm.
And how you interpret your experiences determines how your body's going to respond to your experiences. So mm-hmm. to a great degree, your beliefs actually determine the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Right? Okay.
So that's one job, is there are these lenses that we peer through to see the world. The second job they have, though, is they're like the gatekeepers to our creative flow.
Mm.
And they, and that's what I mean, they're the determinants of conscious expression. And so then the next question is, well, do we have any say over what we believe?
Mm.
And the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
Theoretically, yes. I mean, mm-hmm. but the problem then is how the mind works. So getting back to the hypnosis, you know, how we talked about, you only have one mind, but we divide into these two parts to talk about how they work. So you have your conscious mind and you have the unconscious mind,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at your total mind, how much of it is devoted to your conscious mind and how much of it is devoted
to the unconscious, exactly. It's big. The unconscious is the world, you know.
They figure, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know how they calculate it, but it's probably around 3 to 5% they think is your conscious mind.
Right.
So the unconscious is not only is it running your body, but it's also like your inner wisdom, your Buddha nature, your Christ consciousness. Yeah. There's all these names for it, right? And so you have all these beliefs that you're peering through to see the world. And you have 3 to 5% of your mind is conscious, and that by definition is what you know about.
Mm-hmm.
And the unconscious by definition, you don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know there's a boundary between the two, and information is constantly flowing mm-hmm. back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think most of the beliefs that make up your worldview are? In the 3 to 5% or in the 95, 97%?
Well, 95% as far as I understand, yeah.
Exactly. And it turns out most of the major beliefs that make up your worldview were in place in your psyche by the time you're 7 years old.
So all your belief systems were already conditioned and put into your mind, in your subconscious mind, before the age of 7.
Pretty much, yeah.
So in a way, you don't have a control
at that point.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So most of us get our unconscious mind programmed by chance.
Right.
Yeah. And most of us didn't have perfect parents when we were young.
Yeah. Right.
So
yeah.
If you look at how your mind processes information
mm-hmm.
or how it works, your conscious mind I think of as sort of this cumbersome but really, you know, thorough and complicated information processor, and it can hem and haw and it can have doubts. You know, a lot of times you have to do it over and over again, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to persevere. The unconscious mind, for the most part, just runs algorithms. And it's very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's programmed to keep your sodium within a certain range, keep your potassium within a certain range,
mm-hmm.
keep your skin temperature within a certain range, right? And it's very fast. So, like, if you're driving down the road and a car swerves into your lane,
yeah,
you're reacting with your hands and your feet before your conscious mind recognizes, mm-hmm. There's a car that's coming at you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And so if the unconscious mind just runs these algorithms, and the conscious mind can have doubts and everything. So your conscious mind, we call the ego.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We know how messed up the ego can get, right?
Yes. Right?
But your unconscious mind is just pretty much programmed by chance from your earlier experiences.
Right.
And so what I think of now as a process of healing. So before I do that, one thing. So I looked at, well, where is this inner wisdom? It's not in your ego.
Mm-hmm.
It's deep inner wisdom. And I looked and looked around in my unconscious mind for a lot of years, and I couldn't find it there. And so I personally believe that it's in your, it more, hangs out more in your heart than it does up in your mind.
What about your soul? Do you think it's kind of connected to that as well?
I think that's kind of what the concept of the soul is that consciousness.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So when I was looking for a better model for explaining medicine and science, probably the best model I've come across in all my searching is the Vedic model.
Mm-hmm.
And they see the human being is made up of these six aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And five of them have the suffix Maya in the Sanskrit name.
Mm-hmm.
And Maya means it's not what it really appears to be. It's impermanent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a time you didn't have a body, and there's going to be a time when you don't have a body again.
Mm-hmm.
So your body is called Anamaya Kosha. And they saw these six aspects as arranged like sleeves over sleeves. I think of like the Russian nesting doll,
mm-hmm.
right? So the outermost sleeve was Anamaya Kosha, and Ana means food.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your physical body. That's your biochemistry part, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right underneath that, they saw the Pranamaya Kosha. And prana is your vitality, your vitalized energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you have a biochemical body, you have an energy body.
Mm-hmm.
And prana, we work with when you do Reiki or, you know, in Chinese medicine, they call it qi.
Mm-hmm.
So qigong.
Or the breath, or in yoga, the breath work, right?
Yeah. So,
yeah, right.
Yeah, so pranayama means the laws that govern prana.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's usually through breath, which is really interesting because we call breathing in inspiring. And inspire means to breathe in spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So cultures all around the world have linked breath with spirit a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, but underneath that is they call the Manamaya Kosha. And manas means the aspect of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that as your mind,
mm-hmm.
the Western medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the contents of your mind, all the
mm-hmm.
program, which they call the Manamaya Kosha. And that means your intellect, your personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where most of the beliefs are, so that there's not a mind.
So it's in your personality, the unconscious belief systems.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you're going to make a robot,
mm-hmm.
it would have these four aspects.
Mm-hmm.
It would have a body, it would have a battery pack, it would have a computer, and it would have data and software programmed into the computer.
Mm-hmm.
But as humans, we have two more aspects that the robot won't ever have.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fifth aspect, the Vedic sages named it Anandamaya Kosha.
Mm-hmm.
And Ananda means spiritual bliss.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part of you that can sort of experience the spiritual, but you're still within the laws of physics. It's still a Maya,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So the sixth aspect, they named Atman.
Mm-hmm.
And Atman, notice there's no Maya or Kosha in that
mm-hmm.
name.
Mm-hmm.
So Atman mm-hmm. is your true self.
Right.
But it's conceived of as pure consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But that's outside the laws of physics. So in a Western tradition, Atman would be your immortal soul.
Right, that makes sense.
Your divine, okay. Your divine self,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's spirit, it's pure consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I see that model working. But Western medicine doesn't really have this concept of Anandamaya Kosha.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found in my patients is the more they can connect with that aspect of themselves and identify with that aspect of themselves, the healthier they get.
Mm.
So the more they can be that wise, kind observer, that compassionate observer of themselves living their life, the healthier they get.
Wow.
And so what I see now is the process of healing is essentially the process of reprogramming the unconscious mind with what the heart knows.
Mm-hmm.
So getting out all the, I call them limiting beliefs, the beliefs that tell you that you're smaller than you really are,
mm-hmm.
the divine being.
Mm-hmm.
Removing those beliefs and replacing them with the expanded beliefs that your heart has a deeper understanding of how this world really works, how you fit into the world.
Wow. So how can one actually, I mean, I'm asking you like a direct, straightforward question here. How can one actually reach there if they are not able to reach there, right? Because if you're in your conscious and in your subconscious, but then that's where the kind of inner wisdom is, then the ones who can sense it, but they can't actually reach and operate from there, what could be the journey? I'm guessing it's connected with the seven tools.
Correct.
Of the healing, right? Okay.
Right. So one of the things I noticed, so I think I had a string of patients early on like doing this work that were able to access the inner wisdom fairly easily.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I noticed is when they connected with that inner wisdom and started consulting with it, it kind of took over as their own inner life coach.
Mm.
And it started coaching them in this set of skills.
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, I started noticing the pattern
that
these people, even though they're from really different backgrounds, really different religions, really different socioeconomic backgrounds, once they connect with their inner wisdom, there's a pattern that they're doing that's all the same. And that's, I started to try to figure out that pattern. Mm. And that's where the seven tools come from.
Right.
So,
okay.
And then I started having a whole string of people that seemed to have a really hard time hearing their inner knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd work with them and work with them, work with them, and they just couldn't get it.
Yeah.
And because for the longest time, I didn't want to talk to anybody about the seven tools. I wanted to experience it. Because if I sit here and describe to you how to serve, you're still not going to know how to serve, right?
Right, right, right. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But then I noticed with these people that had a really hard time, if I taught them the seven tools and they went home and started practicing them, then they could connect with their inner wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like a chicken and egg where, you know, the seven tools is the path that people's inner wisdom put them on to heal.
Mm-hmm.
But then if they learn the seven tools, it allowed them to connect with their inner wisdom, which could then take over and help them with the healing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what prompted me to write the book about the seven tools. And because I thought, well, so one thing, I looked at these seven tools, and then I looked at almost all the advice that's out there in the self-help industry right now,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't the same. And I thought, what? Like, how could you have such a disconnect between what people's own inner wisdom tell them to do to heal and what
and the self-help. Yeah, exactly. It's like how we were saying the other day, like, it's like, I feel like a lot of self-help sort of makes you believe or makes you feel like something is wrong with you, or it's like a template that you have to follow, you know? And of course, there are some self-help that are more about your authentic self. They have the authentic self aspect to it, but most of it is like a template of a success that you have to follow, or a template of something that you have to follow because somebody else went through that. And I think that's where it's like you honoring somebody else's experience more than what you're actually experiencing in yourself, right? Is that
right? And most of the things I'm seeing, like so Norman Cousin, he used to be like the editor of the Saturday Evening Post, but he healed himself from ankylosing spondylitis, which is a chronic degenerative arthritis that fuses your spine, and he did it by getting IV vitamin C and watching Charlie Chaplin movies.
Yeah.
And laughing. So people started all these laughing workshops all over the country.
Right.
And they weren't getting the same results that Norman Cousins got.
No. Right. Okay. That's
because he was following his own wisdom about
what to do, right? Yeah.
So what they should have done is started all these workshops on how to follow your own wisdom.
Yeah.
Because that's what was really healing.
Yeah.
That's what healed Debbie McDonald from her ALS.
Yeah.
You know. But anyway, but you see over and over again all these people that have spontaneous healings, and they go, you know, name the technique after themselves and start workshops and teaching and stuff.
Right.
And most of the time, the people don't get the same results because they're not doing what the person really did, which is listen to their own inner wisdom and do what it is. You know, so I started looking at this human experience because all of it affects your health, right?
Mm-hmm.
So human experience can be divided into two large categories. You've got the tangible,
mm-hmm.
which is things you can, you know, see and weigh and measure.
Yeah, and sure.
So I can do all your blood chemistry. I can do a head-to-toe CT scan on you. We can do EEG.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that's all looking at tangible stuff.
Yeah.
But then you have the intangible, like what you love, what inspires you.
What's your soul desiring?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what is it wanting from inside? You know, it's going towards that
soul ride.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you can't weigh and measure that stuff.
No.
So what I see is that the laws of nature run the tangible part of the universe, and the laws of consciousness run the intangible side of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And science has devoted itself to trying to understand these laws of nature, right? But the world wisdom tradition have devoted themselves to understanding these laws of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we never talked about these laws of consciousness in our society.
No.
But yet, that's probably the most important part of our experience, is what's meaningful to us.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So I started looking at, well, what are these laws of consciousness? And one of the things I saw was that consciousness is creative.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason humans are creative is because God's supposed to be the creator, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yet humans are creative, and that's because we can tap into that consciousness too.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and we're not just creative in the way of like art and problem solving and stuff. We're also creative in the sense that we're actually creating our life each moment as it unfolds.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we're creative, and so, but that creativity is flowing from consciousness,
mm-hmm. right?
And only the consciousness, aspect of consciousness that fit what you believe, can come through and become part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so that's one of the first laws, is that consciousness is creative. The second thing I saw was that it flows where you pay attention.
Mm.
So if you move your eyes around the room, wherever your eyes land, you start taking in data and your mind starts interpreting what you see.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's just automatic. It just does that.
Yep.
Well, it turns out that repression and denial are forms of attention.
Are forms of attention?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? Like we're getting attention from the surrounding?
Whatever you're denying, you're actually focusing your attention on it.
Right. Ah, okay. Okay.
Right?
Gotcha.
And so that means your creativity is flowing into whatever you're denying. So what are you creating more of?
Wow, I got a goosebump here. That hit me there.
Yeah. So anytime you're repressing, denying, intellectualizing, rationalizing, you're actually putting your creative energy into more of what you're doing that to. And that's the root of that saying, what you resist persists.
Mm.
You've heard that saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the actual act of resisting it, you're creating more of it, you're strengthening it, you're reinforcing it.
Mm-hmm.
So any process of real change needs to not have any repression or denial, or else it's backfire. And so look at most of the self-help things we do out there, like positive thinking. Well, what happens to all your negative thoughts when you're trying to make yourself positive?
Exactly. What does that mean? That's like manipulating your thoughts and telling yourself a lie to recover yourself. I feel it's not a deep healing, you know?
Right. And it's not. So any time somebody tells you how you're supposed to believe it, that's not going to work. If I tell you how you should be eating, and you try to make yourself eat that way, but then you're repressing and denying all these urges to eat the other way, it's going to backfire. It's not going to work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You see that, and it's so built into our system that we want to repress and deny what we don't want and try to create what we do want. But when we're doing that, we're literally sabotaging ourselves.
There's a conflict.
Yeah.
There's a conflict, you know, where we're fighting inside of ourselves. It's like the soul's wanting something else. It's like desiring something else. But the mind and the intellect and also even the subconscious, the belief system, it's like it's fighting for something else. So there's like a conflict. There's like a rage inside. And it's like, in a way, you don't even feel, if you reflect on it, it's like you don't even feel honest. You don't even feel true to yourself in that moment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I experience it.
You can see it. Yeah. So it sounds like you've seen that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's inadvertent. I don't think most of these self-help techniques want to keep people stuck or want to keep people suffering, but it comes from not really understanding these laws of consciousness, how they work. And so there's another law of consciousness that says, you shall know your truth and the truth shall
set you free.
Yeah. And so if you want to be free of your depression, if you want to be free of your headache, you've got to work with your truth.
And what do we mean by that now? What kind of truth here?
Your truth.
Let's give an example to it.
I think the thing is your truth. And your truth is a subjective truth, right?
Right. Okay.
So let's say, for example, I'm having a headache.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And a lot of times, like a headache is that you need something, but you're not letting yourself have it, for example. And so let's say I come across that belief that, well, I don't deserve to have that, whatever it is in my life.
Right.
Then I say, oh, that's crazy. That's a stupid thing to believe, you know? And so I immediately start pushing on that belief to try to make it go away.
Right.
Well, then I'm going to get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I have to admit the truth. Yeah, I do have a headache.
Mm-hmm.
That's my truth right now in this moment, is that I have a headache.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the other truth is I'm holding this belief that I don't deserve this good thing in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit the truth of it. You know, the belief itself can be wrong.
Right. Yeah.
But your truth is you've been holding on to that belief as if it was true.
Mm.
And so you have to acknowledge that belief. And then what the inner wisdom says is, okay, you see all this that's going on, just be kind to yourself about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just be kind to yourself. And what I notice is when you do that, then things shift.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I call compassion the alchemist. Because it's what works to change in your life. Mm-hmm. If you get in and try to force it to change, it's going to get caught in an arms race with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if you can just see your truth, yes, and just go, I even do this time with my hands off. I'm not going to try to get in there and try to make this thing. I'm just going to go like this, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to see the truth, and I'm just going to open my heart to myself and having that truth.
Right.
So when you're focusing on opening your heart, where's your creativity going?
If you're focusing yourself on your heart, where's your creativity going? It's going into your heart.
Yeah.
Right.
So what are you going to create more of?
Love and peace and beauty.
Yeah. And then you let that love and peace and beauty work to change. So if you think about reality, all that exists is right now.
Right. This moment. This moment is the most authentic moment and the true moment. I mean, okay.
That's all there is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And the past is gone. The future's not here yet.
Mm-hmm.
So this present moment has the influences from the past, but it also contains all the potential for all the possible futures.
Right, yeah.
So there's plenty enough to work on here. We don't have to pay for it, you know? And so what you're trying to become aware of is the truth of this moment for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that would include, okay, what's going on biochemically in your body?
Mm-hmm.
What thoughts are running through your mind? How is the environment affecting you?
Mm-hmm.
How's your social support? You know, all that, those are aspects of your truth right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so one of the skills that the inner wisdom teaches people is that awareness, that mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more aspects of your truth right now you can become aware of, the more you can work on it.
Mm-hmm.
The less you're denying and repressing, you know. And what awareness does is it moves things from the not known over to the known.
To the known.
So awareness is a great way to start to plumb and explore the unconscious by pushing awareness into there. One of the ways I use hypnosis is I think of it like we're going on a safari into the unconscious mind or a fact-finding mission. We're just going to go in there and see what it thinks it's up to.
Yeah.
And then we can have a dialogue with it, compare it with what your heart wants to do. And that. So that's how I think about healing is, like I said, finding out what's in the unconscious mind, and reprogramming it with what your heart knows. And it turns out that practicing the seven tools is not the only way, of course, but it's a fairly simple, reliable way to do that work.
So it's like you're relying on yourself rather than another form of,
I mean, obviously, you can work with a therapist this way, but you know, there's a lot of therapy going on that's not probably as good as it could be.
Yeah.
Because again, so if I look at these self-help techniques, the thing that gets in the way of them working as well as they could is they don't work well with how the unconscious mind works.
Mm-hmm.
Because like your unconscious mind doesn't hear knock.
Mm-hmm.
If you say, don't forget your lunch,
mm-hmm.
you're more likely to forget your lunch. And if you say, remember to take your lunch, see? Because to don't it, to not it, you have to create it in your unconscious mind first.
Right.
So you're still creating it. So the unconscious mind doesn't hear knock.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other aspects of it. But the other thing they don't do is they don't obey the laws of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting is if you break a law of physics, something breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Like the beam fails or
you
slide off the road, you can take a corner too fast.
Yeah.
Something breaks. But when you break a law of consciousness, what happens is human suffering increases.
Mm.
Right? So one of the reasons that the Declaration of Independence has the power to transform that it had was that it stated a law of consciousness in the Declaration.
Mm-hmm.
And that law is, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident,
mm-hmm.
meaning we don't have to go in the laboratory and prove them.
Mm-hmm.
All, I said, they said, man, I said, all humans are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that true? Because we have different physical bodies, we have different intellectual capacities,
mm-hmm.
have, right? Different problem solving skills. How is it that we're all equal?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is our lives are of equal value.
Mm-hmm.
My life is no more or no less important than your life.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the power of it. And look what happens when that law gets broken. And people are treated with discrimination or with prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What happens when I'm acting like my life is more important than your life?
Mm-hmm.
So that increases human suffering.
Right.
So anyway, there's a whole bunch of these, there's a number of these laws of consciousness that, again, you get from studying the different wisdom traditions. And as long as you can stay true to them in your own process, your own healing work, you'll progress a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you start violating and your own suffering.
Right. So looking at the seven tools of healing,
mm-hmm.
shall we just go into the process of it, like step by step? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think just...
Let's say if somebody... Oh, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
If I just explain what they are, and then we can talk about how you can use them to find and change limiting beliefs.
Right.
So the first tool I think of as a foundation that everything's laid on. And the word the inner wisdom uses for that tool is faith.
Faith.
And I had a hard time with that word at first because it's been co-opted by certain factions in our society. And so there's a lot of assumptions around that word, right?
Right.
But what the inner wisdom uses it for is to talk about how strongly you believe what you believe.
And when we say faith, do we mean God? Do we mean faith in ourselves? Do we mean faith in the spirit? Or do we mean, what do we mean by that?
So that's the assumption that our society makes is that faith that you're assuming you hold a certain set of beliefs.
Right.
Like a certain religious teaching,
whatever.
So what the inner wisdom says is it's not what you believe, it's how strongly you believe it.
Mm. Oh, okay. Interesting.
It's like the voltage behind your belief.
It's about the belief. It's about the faith rather than what you have faith in.
Right. Then the next challenge is, so then you get to choose what to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So why not choose to believe what helps you the most?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so for a lot of people, believing that there is a kind, wise, benevolent being is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
My own, personally, I conceive of that as that consciousness we talked about that is behind all of creation. That's how, mm-hmm. when I hear the word God, that's what I think of.
Yeah.
And in the Vedic system, they call that Brahma,
mm-hmm.
or Purusha. In the Lakota system, they call it Maka. It just means sacred bigness. You know?
Yeah.
And in the Jewish system, they don't even give it a name. It's name.
Mm-hmm.
It's the system of everything, right?
Right.
So all these tools get better with practice. But mm-hmm. once you choose a belief, you can practice strengthening your belief in it. And what that does is that increases your probability of being able to manifest that belief.
Okay.
So
you're able to manifest that thing that you're believing in. Okay.
And even Muhammad Ali said that when your belief reaches the level of certainty, all kinds of things can happen.
It becomes possible. It becomes real for you. It's like you're you have so much conviction into it that it almost becomes a reality, and then it turns into a reality.
There's no choice. It has to be
right. Yeah.
And so that's what practices of faith are based on. They say choose these beliefs and then practice having really, really strong faith in them so that these beliefs matter.
Do you think the visualization helps into it as well in some way, into this faith aspect?
So you have to be careful with visualization, because that's the other way of telling yourself what to think or believe in. And visualizations are a really big part of most of the self-help techniques that are getting all the big pundits out there teaching.
That's true. Okay, makes sense.
And with visualizations, you can put a new belief into your unconscious mind,
mm-hmm.
but it won't necessarily get the old limiting belief out.
So it adds into it, but it's not really, it's not unlearning it. It's not cleaning it. It's not healing it.
Right. Not necessarily. Okay. If it's done a certain way, it could.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
It's not.
Okay. Interesting.
And the image I have, remember those old overhead projectors they used in school?
Put
the transparency on and they take one transparency off.
Yeah.
Well, imagine what it looked like if you just kept piling transparencies on it and didn't take the old ones off.
Yeah. Oh my God. That would be a messed up head.
Yeah. So visualizations, you have to be really careful with them because they can just be a better way of being your ego being controlling.
Sure. Okay.
So, but that brings up the second tool, which is awareness. Mm-hmm. And so the inner wisdom constantly coaches people on pay attention. You know, you're constantly showing yourself who you are. You just have to pay attention.
So pay attention of knowing who you are.
Yep. How are you feeling?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what thoughts your mind thinking? What's going on in your joints? What's going on in your intestines? You know, what's going on around you? How people are treating you? So be aware. Be mindful. And in the Lakota tradition, they call that the red road. That's the road of going through life with your eyes open.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the black road, which is going through the life with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
So similar teachings in all these different traditions, right?
Right.
But anytime you think about mindfulness, a lot of meditative techniques are practicing awareness. And then what you do with what you become aware of. And what the inner wisdom says is you have to acknowledge that's your truth.
You have to acknowledge it. That's your true.
Yeah, you have to acknowledge it. So for a long time, I used the word surrender for the third tool, and I really liked that word. But I found that was a big trigger for a lot of people too, because a lot of people think that if you surrender, that means you're a quitter, and it's not really. But what you're doing is you're stop fighting against your own truth. So what's the point of it? Your truth is what it is. Why try to say no? It's not. It doesn't change it, right?
Yeah.
So I just use the word acceptance now. So
actually, sorry to, I just you triggered me something on that. I feel like there's this notion of attachment people have with the idea of not giving up, of not, and what you just said about surrender, it kind of triggered me. Like, I personally feel surrendering is a way to actually knowing yourself more and letting go of the things that are not serving you, so you can actually go organically towards what's sort of working for you. But the, again, I feel like with the self-help ideas, it's like never give up, never, it's like you're holding on to something that may not even necessarily be you, you know? So anyway, I just, it just came as a thought.
And that's another kind of conundrum, and that's that whole the spiritual warrior,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you look at the characteristics of a warrior, they are someone who like practices their skills till they're really good at them, and they have a lot of tenacity, right? Because if you give up as a warrior, you can't get killed,
mm-hmm.
right? And like they have a saying in rock climbing that you don't fall until you've given up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something to be said about that tenacity, but the tenacity itself is not the problem. It's how you aim it.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you use it on, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you use it to stay stuck, you're gonna get really good at being stuck.
No,
right?
Then it's like, yeah, you need to give up on being stuck, basically.
Right. So you need to use that tenacity to find to follow that soul, your soul's yearning
or journey or pull
or pull. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So because that does take tenacity, because there's a lot of ways to get discouraged. There's a lot of ways to give up, because it can be hard sometimes.
Yeah.
You might have
totally
to deal with some really hard feelings.
Yeah.
You know, people who were abused as kids have mm-hmm. to a lot of work to reclaim their sovereignty and release the hurt, you know, the PTSD mm-hmm. and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that tenacity does come in handy. You just have to aim it right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same way with most of the tools in conventional medicine. I don't have any problem with surgery and antibiotics, medications, mm-hmm. as long as they're used with the right cost.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you might as well take advantage of them. They're really powerful tools. You know?
Mm-hmm.
They can be very handy sometimes.
Yeah.
And so holism has to include conventional medicine. And, but anyway, so the inner wisdom says you've got to really admit your truth to yourself.
Right.
And then the fourth tool is, and keep saying, okay, this is your truth. Well, just give yourself a hug. Just be kind to yourself about it.
So it's compassion and love?
Compassion is the fourth tool.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so tools 2, 3, and 4, I think of as the engine of change. You become aware of something, you acknowledge the truth of it, you open your heart to it, and then the next moment is just a little bit kinder than the last moment was. You see your truth in that moment, acknowledge it, open your heart to it. The next moment that unfolds is a little bit kinder than that one was.
Mm.
And so as the moments unfold, the kindness just, it's like turning a battleship, you know, the kindness just starts working with little incremental changes, and pretty soon your life is steaming off the hold.
Mm.
But it's guided by the kindness.
Mm.
Because if your change is guided by your ego, it's really easy to jump from the frying pan into the fire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you're still struggling, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so, but the heart knows
mm-hmm.
what you're, you know. And you could say soul, what your soul.
Yeah.
If the soul was driving your life, if the soul was creating your life for you, what are the chances you create a life that you like?
What are the chances of what are the chances of?
That you would create a life that you like.
There'll be many chances. There'll be many chances. I will. I mean, if I can feel my guiding system, which I am right now in my life, for example, and then I will be following it without any doubt,
Most people's creativity is being guided by their fear.
Mm.
And so what are the chances you're going to like that one?
What are the chances? If you're driven by fear, then yeah, you will be guiding by that. Totally.
And that's why most people don't like their life.
Right. And that's why most people are unhappy. Okay. That makes sense.
Because the life they've the moment you've created right now is from all the previous moments that were fear-based.
See, and so so it's like a vicious cycle. There's a fear-based cycle, and then there's a soul-based cycle. So it's like there's a separation between the two, right? Okay.
Yep. And so you can create out of fear. Mm-hmm. You can create out of anger.
Mm-hmm.
You can create out of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And you can create out of hedonism or, you know, superficial happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in any of those things, you're not going to like those lives as much as if you were creating out of love or out of soul knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the idea, is to see if you can get a hold of your creative influences and shift them over to soul knowing. And again, you can't force it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's the, you've got to do it by seeing that right now, I'm creating out of fear, creating out of fear, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to be kind to myself about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the things I work with myself is anytime I make a self-observation, I end it with, and I can be kind to myself about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like I'm having a bad hair day today. Well, okay, so I can be kind to myself about that.
Right, okay.
Right. I've got a headache today. I can be kind to myself about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I just got in a fight with my kid. Okay, well, I can be kind to myself about that. So, mm-hmm. so that's just the practice.
Yeah.
So then what happens when you bring enough compassion to enough aspect of the situation then generally the forgiveness just makes sense. If there's any forgiveness that's needed, it'll just be like an aha moment. It'll just make sense. Now you can practice forcing forgiveness. Like if somebody hurt you, forcing yourself to forgive them, or if you made a mistake, trying to force yourself to forgive yourself. But that's not going to cause a transformation. But if the forgiveness just follows because you brought enough compassionate, accepting awareness to what happened, then that changes. And I've been working on people, doing the training work on people, when they hit that moment of forgiveness, and you just feel it through their whole body. Their body shifts.
So to add more to understand more forgiveness in a deeper way, the forgiveness, just to clarify, the forgiveness is the forgiveness of the moment, forgiveness of the self, or forgiveness of the person who did you wrong?
All of it.
Okay. So everything. So,
yeah. One of my definitions of forgiveness is where you finally give up all hope that the past will ever be forgiven.
Okay. Damn. That's good.
I
like it. Love it. Yeah.
And that's acceptance, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
It's kind of cool. There's a symmetry around compassion where you've got acceptance right before compassion, and you've got forgiveness, which is actually a result of that acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So how does one know they've reached that forgiveness?
It's not a button. Like if you talk about the person that rear-ended you,
mm-hmm.
it's not a button. It's, you know, you just talk about it and it doesn't change your pulse. It doesn't.
Right. Okay.
And I've seen people reach that kind of forgiveness around, you know, the rapist, people that murdered their kids.
Wow. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Their parents, whatever, you know, incest, whatever.
Yeah.
But again, you know, every major world tradition teaches forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is you need forgiveness as you go through life. Otherwise, your backpack just fills up with too many boulders.
Baggages.
And pretty soon you can't walk any further, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you really need that letting go to keep going through life.
Yeah.
But again, the true transformational forgiveness happens when the compassion works. You know, it's almost like every situation has a compassion threshold. And once you build your compassion to that threshold, then the forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've observed with people.
Wow.
And then the next tool is gratitude. And have you ever had that, an experience where it's kind of like the curtains open and you just sort of see what spirit's been up to all along?
Yeah.
You know, and you go, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's that standing in awe of how this whole universe really works.
Yeah.
That's the gratitude I'm talking about. And I've had people get that experience from, you know, from their cancer, from car accidents, whatever. And they might come in and say, well, I wouldn't want to go through that again, but I'm happy I did because of all I know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and how much I've grown and changed because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the kind of gratitude. And I sort of use that as a yardstick. So when somebody can come in and say that about their disease or their injury or whatever, then I know they've gotten a healing.
Right.
That experience.
So that's the final destination of the healing, actually. That's when you know you've actually healed.
Yeah. When you can truly be grateful for whatever experience you have.
And it's not the gratitude in a, it's not a gratitude in a sense that the, it's not that you want that again, but it's more that you're ungrateful that it happened where you are now. Right. Okay.
Yeah. And a lot of people wouldn't want to go through it again. But, and then the last tool is just right action.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the last part. Okay. Oh, yeah, because this is okay.
The seven tools. So how do you know that what you do is going to bring about the results that you want?
You mean what you do in the future? Like as in what the next steps?
Well, let's say you make a choice right now. Like let's say you're going to choose to buy this stock.
Yeah.
How do you know that stock's going to do well?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, right? For sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or let's say you choose to do this exercise today.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that exercise is going to give
me the result that I'm looking to get? Okay.
Yeah. And so the answer is you don't, because everything's just probability.
Right. Yeah.
But how do you increase the probability so that, you know, you actually do get benefit from exercise, you actually do get benefit from taking on this job or this client? You know, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea is that right action is based on right understanding. And my contention is if you practice the first six tools, you'll arrive at right understanding, and then you'll just know what to do in the moment. You know, you'll just know what to eat. You'll just know how to exercise. You'll just know what to say to that child. You'll just know. And a lot of people say that they're being guided by, sometimes they see their inner wisdom like angels talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they see their inner wisdom like, you know, God talking to them. However, you know, but that's kind of what we're looking for. And so right action generally, it's not just what's right for you, but it usually is the highest good for the highest number of sensual beings.
Okay.
Aspect of right action.
So the right action is not just connected with right action, what it's right for you, but it's also right action because it just feels right as everything is interconnected and the consciousness for the entire being, right?
Right. Yeah.
Like my action, whatever action I take is going to affect others around me. It's going to affect me also, but it's going to affect others around me as well. So
and
I have to do the right thing. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the idea is that your own inner wisdom knows what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many factors to take into account. It's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But almost all the sciences, you know, science, sociology, economics, political science, they're all trying to answer that question, how do I know my actions are going to give me the results I want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, business, studying business. We've been trying to answer that question as long as we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that your inner wisdom can help with that.
And
choosing the right action to give you the desired result.
So once you're in your inner wisdom, and once you go through the journey and the process, then you actually consciously know what the right action is for yourself?
It just kind of rises up.
All right, okay. So you know it. Yeah.
You might think of that as your intuition tells you. I know a
listening
lot of people that say that they're following their angel guidance or whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter if
what
you
call it.
Yeah. But I think it's good to own your own power.
Mm.
Say, yeah, I can know. I have this deep knowing. It's part of who I am. And I can listen to that. And that's that saying you have inside you that answers all of your questions.
Mm.
You ever heard that saying?
No. Say it again.
You have inside of you the answers to all of your questions.
I haven't heard the saying, but I think it's something that I can relate with totally, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So the only person I've ever heard say no to that question is my brother. I don't have the answers to all my questions. Yeah. Okay. he's a conventional medical nurse practitioner.
Right, right. That's funny.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's the seven tools. And so one way to use them is by starting to really pay close attention to your feelings.
Your feelings.
Your feelings, yeah.
Okay.
Because at the beginning, if you look at how your mind works, you have all this sensory input coming into your mind. Mm-hmm. Everything that you see, hear, taste, touch, smell comes in. You have thoughts going in your mind all the time, and you have these intuitions. You have all this information from your body coming into your mind, right? And then all that information passes through those beliefs that we talked about, that rack of lenses that in psychology they call your structure of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And then what comes out the other side of that lens is your interpretation of all these experiences, which is how you feel about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then how you feel is going to determine how you react.
Mm-hmm.
So your feelings drive your actions, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you look at that system, you got all this input, you got this rack of lenses, and then the feelings. You basically have a constant flow of feelings going on inside because you have a constant stream of information coming into your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're in a sensory deprivation thing, your mind is still thinking its own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this constant stream of feelings, which is basically your interpretation of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How it's being interpreted through these lenses.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the idea is that the feeling itself is never the problem. Right? But how many therapeutic techniques do you know are aimed at changing how you feel?
To change how you feel.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like I want to not feel this way anymore, and I want to feel this other way.
Yeah. Ah, yeah. It's like changing the way you feel. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so if you're working on the feeling itself, you're way too superficial.
Okay.
Right. You're not getting to the cause.
No.
The cause is either the belief or the input. Right?
So it's in the thoughts or in the belief system, the cause.
Right. It's either in the if you're having a painful feeling here, and the problem's over here, you're probably getting abused, or or you're having a natural disaster happening around you, or something, right? But a lot of times, and you only have so much control over your input.
Mm-hmm.
You don't control if it's sunny or cloudy, or if you leave your home and get stuck in a traffic jam.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't control what other people say to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people try to control that, but it doesn't work.
Right, right.
So try to control their spouse. You can't talk to me that way. We only have so much control over here. So where you have most of the control is in these lenses. But most of those lenses are in the unconscious part of your mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you can see, okay, my best friend just said this to me, and it generated this feeling in me. What belief did that?
Okay.
And so by following the feeling back to the belief that generated it, you can start to uncover those beliefs in the unconscious part of your mind. And so then once you uncover that belief, that means it's moved from the unconscious over to the conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And once it's in the conscious, it's like having the file open on your computer screen. You can work on it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so then that's when you say, okay, this is the belief I've been holding. What would my heart say about that belief?
Ah, so you recheck. So first you discover what the belief system is. Then you recheck, does my soul align, does my heart align to that belief system or not? Because that's where the truth is. Okay, I got you.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so you're admitting that you're admitting your truths. You're not resisting or denying them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And you're just asking, how does this belief... One of my questions to myself is, how does this belief look through spirit eyes?
Mm.
Or what would my soul say about this belief? What would my heart say about this belief?
Right.
What would God say about this belief? you know, whatever your own beliefs are about that. But what you're doing is essentially checking your belief with a higher spiritual truth.
Of your, it's a higher spiritual of your, of yourself, like your own inner truth. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And usually just asking that question is enough to get that belief to shift.
Mm-hmm.
If that's how you're getting the old belief out of the unconscious mind, and then the new belief can go back into the unconscious mind, and then your friend can say the exact same thing to you next week, but a whole different feeling comes out.
Mm.
And that's how you know it's really changed.
And that's how you're actually letting go of the belief system you're holding on to.
Yeah.
By rechecking with your own alignment. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what I see in my patients is the more their own personal structure of interpretation starts to harmonize and line up with the higher truth, the healthier they get.
That's amazing. What happens when somebody who's gone through a journey and they've actually have healed themselves, but life obviously keeps bringing you different kind of traumas, right? Can then this tool be applied again into getting back into that? Because obviously life happens, right? Like issues happen, things happen, and there might be many other kind of belief system that might come to the surface that we didn't realize that it needs to let go of, right? So can that then use as a cycle of this seven healing process? Because then this time, okay, I fixed this issue in myself, or I realign myself to this, but what do I think about something else, you know, and how can I realign? So does that work like that?
It does. And it's kind of like peeling back the layers.
Right.
You know, and you usually work with the ones, the top one that you can see. Once you peel that back, then you can start seeing what's underneath that. You apply the tool for that. Get that aligned with the higher knowing, and then that peel back to the next layer. And it seems like, at least what I've observed so far, is as long as you're drawing breath, there's usually work to do. Healing work to do. You know, there are probably really fully enlightened people that have already arrived there. And, you know.
Yeah.
I think there are yogis that have made amazing accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
That way, you know, Buddhist monks, yogis, stuff like that. So, you know, Buddha was one of those kind of people that had big full. That's what, you know, Ken Wilber's talking about, the full actualization of the human potential.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there have been a few examples down through history of people doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, most of us, it's a journey. We're still on that path to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think this is a reasonable approach. It's a good. I've seen it really help people. I've seen people heal chronic disease that medicine says you can't heal. I've seen people heal childhood traumas that have been haunting them their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things. I've seen people have tumors going away.
Mm-hmm.
Arthritic joints getting better, you know. So I think that the healing that's possible is, we haven't even scratched the surface yet of what that is.
Right.
And we're mainly just limited by our own imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when it comes to healing, dream big. Mm-hmm. And this is where that tenacity comes in. Don't give up until you're satisfied with
the process of the healing.
With your life, yeah. Because right. I think what our soul is searching for, my own opinion, is part of that anandamaya kosha is deep inner bliss, this deep inner happiness that's unaffected by
what's happening outside.
It's unaffected by how much money you have, by how people are treating you, by what's going on in world politics. Pandemic, any of that. It's not affected by that. And I think that's what, when we're trying to find happiness and we're looking on the surface for it, what we're really wanting is that deep bliss. So we just keep going. And we keep finding that, well, this happiness works as long as these conditions are there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as people are nice to me, I'm going to be happy. So as soon as you mean to me, I'm going to be happy.
Right.
That means your happiness is dependent on other people.
Other people's opinion or other people's judgments or other people, how they treat you, right? Not how you feel about yourself. And
right. So if you have the sense that your healing depends on somebody else being different than they are, then you're being a victim.
Mm.
And I've never seen anybody heal and remain a victim at the same time.
You've never seen anybody heal when they're being a victim at the same time.
Right. Now, there's a difference between being a victim and being victimized.
Right.
I mean, we're all victimized at some point because things happen because we don't ask.
Right.
But being a victim is how you see yourself.
Mm. So if you're being a victim, then the healing is not possible?
I haven't seen it happen yet. Okay. I've been watching for 35 years.
Wow, that's interesting. So if a person is actually being a victim in their story or in their journey,
they're stuck.
Then they're stuck. So they're probably going to stay there. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And so in those people, one of the first things people's inner wisdom does to them is to help them connect with their true source of power. Because if you're connected to your true source of power, you're not victim. You can take responsibility for yourself. You can get yourself out of abusive situations. That sort of thing. So connecting to your own source of power, and where that's felt in the body for a lot of people is the third chakra, the solar plexus area.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's sort of what I've seen with that. But yeah, one of the first important steps in the healing process is to reclaim your sovereignty.
So I have a question to ask about the victim one. So if somebody is into being a victim, can they then never come out even with the help of 7 tools? Or do you think with the 7 tools it can help them?
Oh, it can help them.
Okay.
If they want to.
So it's all about if you want to.
Right.
Okay.
You probably heard that old joke of how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know. I never heard this joke.
Only one, but the light
only,
bulb
which
has
is you.
To want to change.
Right.
Well, it only takes one psychiatrist.
Okay.
But the light bulb has to want to change.
Right, only if you want to. So it's all connected if you want to. Okay.
Yeah. So so that again, so that's again that catch-22 between desire and letting go of desire. You know, a lot of spiritual passages, you've got to let go of desire, you've got to kill your ego, that kind of thing. But that desire to connect with your soul, that desire to get healthy, get your physical functioning back so you can go on a hike, whatever you want to do, you know. I think that desire is a good thing, again, as long as it's useful.
Mm.
So, and in alignment with the laws of consciousness and the laws of time. So for real healing, we've got to put both of those laws together and work with both the tangible and the intangible in healthy, reliable ways.
Right, okay.
And that's what's not happening in most of the self-help.
That makes sense. So I know that there's a book, obviously, with the 7 tools of healing. But how does one can actually apply in the practice? Because I remember you mentioned that there's a workshop that they can, if somebody sort of feels like, okay, this resonates with me, I want to kind of work on certain parts of myself that I want to heal. How can that actually?
So the 7 tools obviously are actually the word 7 skill, right? And so just because you have a tool in your workshop doesn't mean you can get masterful results with it.
Right.
You still have to practice, right?
Right.
And so the best way we have of practicing the 7 tools right now is a class that we're teaching. It's called Taming the Bear, taking the bite out of stress. So basically what we did is we chose stress as the index condition because so many of us have stress and it's just getting worse and worse all the time. Right?
So
how do you make yourself impervious to stress so that stress doesn't destroy your health.
Yeah.
And so we use the 7 tools on that example. But so by helping yourself become impervious to stress, then you learn the 7 tools that you can then apply to any other issue in your life. So whether it's parenting or relationship, your job.
Right. Yeah. Here.
So that's an online class. The website is it's just the number 7.
7tools.com, right? We'll put it on okay.
And we're starting a new class, I think January 7th. And the way we teach it is it's a 12-week class, and each week you get a new chapter released that has like a video that explains the concepts for that week. But then there's also an hour and a half group call. Everybody in the class calls in, and it's like a group coaching session. Teaching session, and then we just do that for 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that gives you a chance to really, you know, practice until these things become second nature, and to get your questions answered, to be able to apply them to a couple of your own personal students. And there's also an option to take the class where you don't participate live in the call, but you just listen in after the recording afterwards, and work on your own, and that, which is a lot less expensive. So there's both options available.
Okay. So if somebody wants to kind of look into the seven tools of healing, so the one approach is the book, and the other is the actual workshop that's happening where you actually learn it in a practical way for the next 12 weeks. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So thank you.